Let's open our Bibles to Amos chapter number 9, where we pick up in verse number 11, which is a very important verse for us, these next two verses, because they are quoted by the Apostle James. That's James, the half-brother of Jesus, who was the apostle appointed by Jesus to the church at Jerusalem. But he will quote it in Acts chapter 15 as part of his support of the idea that the gospel needs to go to the Gentiles as well as the Jews. We'll develop that idea more clearly after we read here in Amos chapter 9. So, Amos chapter 9, verse 11. In that day, now what day? After the judgment of God has fallen upon northern Israel, but when God has reserved for himself a remnant to start over with again. So that's the transition from Old Testament to New Testament time that we're talking about. So in that day, the day of the gospel, I will raise up the booth of David that has fallen and repair its breaches and raise up its ruins and rebuild it as in the days of old. Now, this is interesting. Remember that Amos is preaching to northern Israel, a people group that has abandoned the kingdom of David and Solomon, and they've had their own non-Davidic dynasties going on for quite some time now. But God directs Amos in this context to talk about the idea that the Davidic kingdom is also going to fall apart. It is also going to fail. Now, the northern kingdom is going to have its final failure in 723 BC. The southern kingdom of Judah will have a similar collapse, 587 BC. So the Davidic kingdom is going to be collapsing like a tent. And so here is a prediction of how it's going to be brought back up again and be rebuilt. Now, the rebuilding is going to happen in Jesus Christ. Jesus is the Son of David who is going to take over the throne of Israel. And that will first become evident at his resurrection. All right, so let's read a little bit more before we shift over to the Acts 15 application of this. Verse 12. That they may possess the remnant of Edom. Now, that's our English Standard Version's translation. It's the typical translation in the other versions as well. New American Standard, I think NIV also has it. But that is not the Greek Old Testament translation of it. It is actually the word for mankind. The word Edom and Adam have the same consonants. And remember, in ancient Hebrew, you only used consonants. You didn't have vowel pointing. And so I believe that the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Hebrew into, well, Greek, that happened in the 3rd century BC, I believe it's correct in saying that this is the word for mankind here. And so, that they may possess the remnant of mankind, and that all the nations, all the ethnic groups who are called by my name, declares he who is, who does this. Now let's go to the New Testament to verify that that's how this passage is supposed to be understood, that it's about Jesus and the coming of the Gentiles into Jesus' kingdom. Acts chapter 15, starting at verse 13, is the context we'll read in a moment, but first let me remind you of the historical context. We got Judaizers who are in the church. These are Jewish people, Pharisees mostly, who are insisting that every Gentile has to convert to Judaism in its traditional form, or they can't be saved by Jesus. They have to become Jewish. They have to Judaize. And Paul, who is the apostle of Jesus to the Gentiles, is going, no, that's not right. They don't have to do that. And so he comes to Jerusalem and starts conferring with other apostles to verify that they are on the same page with him, that no, Gentile people don't have to become Jewish to be saved by Jesus. And so after the reports were made by Paul and Barnabas, verse 13 of Acts 15 says, after they had stopped speaking, James answered. So this is James, the half-brother of Jesus, the apostle to the Jewish church at Jerusalem, saying, brethren, listen to me. Simeon, that's Peter, who also has already spoken in this conference, has related how God first concerned himself about taking from among the Gentiles a people for his name. Meaning, Peter didn't just simply get to preach the Pentecost sermon to Jewish people at the beginning of the church. He got to preach to the Gentile people in the house of Cornelius to welcome Gentiles into the church. And there was nothing about this Judaizing nonsense that Gentiles have to keep kosher and be circumcised and keep the feasts and all of that. Verse 15, James continues, and with this the words of the prophets agree, just as it is written, after these things I will return, and I will rebuild the tabernacle of David which has fallen, and I will rebuild its ruins, and I will restore it, in order that the rest of mankind may seek he who is the Lord, and all the Gentiles who are called by my name. That's a quote from the Septuagint version, the Greek version of Amos chapter 9, verses 11 and 12. James, the apostle to the church at Jerusalem, quotes exactly how I was talking about in a moment ago, that this is all about the fact that Jesus has rebuilt the kingdom of David, and he is the king who is bringing salvation, not just simply to the Jews, but to all of mankind, because all of the Gentiles are going to be able to call on the name of the Lord and be saved. The rest of the passage in Acts says the Lord who makes these things known from of old. And then he goes on, and I think it's important that we go ahead and re-emphasize that Judaizing is it's a heresy. It is a false teaching. The church very clearly taught against it here in Acts chapter 15, and Paul very clearly taught against it in multiple of his letters. So James goes on and says in verse number 19, therefore, it's my judgment that we don't trouble those who are turning to God from among the Gentiles, but that we write to them that they abstain from things contaminated by idols, meaning that they don't go and eat in the pagan temples anymore, because that's worship of those gods and goddesses, and that they abstain from fornication, meaning sleeping around. Both of these things come from before the law. You weren't supposed to be partying with pagans, and you weren't supposed to be playing around on your spouse. and from what is strangled and from blood. And again, while the Jewish people were really big on not eating meat that had not been properly bled out and not allowing blood to be eaten on purpose, such as in a blood sausage or something like that, that's in the law of Moses, it actually goes back to Genesis chapter number 9, well before the law, that nobody was supposed to be eating arterial blood because the blood represented life and the atonement for sin. And so even to this day, nobody on the planet should be partying with pagans, sleeping around on their spouse, or eating arterial blood on purpose. It has nothing to do with being Jewish. That's just wrong, all of those things. And so James basically is agreeing that these Gentile people don't have to become Jewish. They don't have to get circumcised. They don't have to keep kosher. They don't have to keep the feasts. They don't have to keep the Jewish law. They just have to keep the standards of God for all of humanity. Don't party with pagans. Don't cheat on your spouse. And don't eat arterial blood. That's it. And then he says, for Moses from ancient generations says, every city, those who preach him, since he's read in the synagogues every Sabbath. We got plenty of people that are talking about Moses and the Jewish law if they want to be part of that. But no, we're not going to make Gentiles who believe in Jesus become Jewish. Okay. So the support for that from James comes from our passage in Amos chapter 9. Let's go back to chapter 9 now. Now comes the millennial passage at the tail end of the book of Amos. Now, I call it a millennial passage, even though the millennium is not mentioned here by that number. The 1,000 years are only mentioned specifically in the book of Revelation. But the millennium is a stand-in for the new heaven and new earth that comes into existence when Jesus splits the skies. Not only do we get new bodies, creation gets a new body. And as Jesus rules and reigns, everything goes back to the way it was before sin entered this current creation. And so that's the prediction that we see here at the end of the book of Amos. Behold, the days are coming, declares he who is, when the plowman shall overtake the reaper, meaning that they'll still be bringing in the harvest of grain whenever people are starting to plow the fields to put the new crop into the ground. That doesn't typically happen unless you got an awful lot of harvest. And the treader of grapes, him who sows the seed. So when you take the grapes off of the grapevines and you start making your vintage, if you have so much to press into new wine, you might start running into those that are out there sowing the fields with grain, which doesn't typically happen until much later than the vintage time. And so effectively what we're seeing here at the beginning of verse number 13 is extreme prosperity, extreme fertility, which is exactly what we expect to see in the new heavens and the new earth. The mountains shall drip sweet wine, and all the hills shall flow with it. So another description of great agricultural prosperity. Verse 14, God continues talking. I will restore the fortunes of my people Israel. Now, he has just been telling Amos to pass on about the judgment, that wrath is coming, death, destruction, exile. But once Messiah comes on the scene and the new dynasty, the enduring dynasty of Messiah comes to fruition, and the Gentiles are brought into the kingdom as full members of that society, then God is going to bring blessings. So I'm going to restore the fortunes of my people Israel. They shall rebuild the ruined cities and inhabit them. They shall plant vineyards and drink their wine. They shall make gardens and eat their fruit. That's the promises of the blessings in the book of Deuteronomy, everything is going to be great. I will plant them on their land. And then the next line is very important to understand the timing of this prophecy. And they shall never again be uprooted out of the land that I've given them, says He who is your God. So this is not a prophecy, as some people try to make it, of the return of Israel out of Babylonian and Assyrian exile, because they went into exile again after that. And I don't think, honestly, that it is a prediction of Israel coming back and making the modern state of Israel either, because they do not have peace and prosperity right now. And it is possible, although not likely, that they could be uprooted again. I believe that this is a reference to the millennial period, when Jesus Christ comes back and establishes His kingdom on the new earth under the new heaven. That's my belief. That's my teaching. And I'm always open to having conversations about it. So this is, I think, one of the first times that we see in the Old Testament writings about that great future, prosperous, peaceful kingdom of the Messiah. At this point, I want you to open up to the book of Hosea. I told you that we're going to start seeing more and more of the written Old Testament prophecy books as we're in this final phase of the northern kingdom of Israel. A lot of the prophecies are directed toward them. And so this new prophecy is from a man named Hoshea. We say in English, typically, Hosea. Hoshea's name is actually the original name of the guy we know of as Joshua. The word Hoshea in Hebrew means salvation. And so back in the time of the Exodus, Moses took Hoshea, the son of Nun, as his adjutant, as his lieutenant, as his second in command, and he gave him a new name. He took the shortened form of Yahweh, just the Yah part, and stuck it on the front of Hosea, and so it took on a new pronunciation and a new meaning. Yahoshua, He who is salvation. And of course, we know that a much later person in the story was born at Bethlehem, and by the direction of the angel to his mother and a direction of the angel to his stepfather or his adopted father, he was given the name Yehoshua, Joshua, or in Greek, Jesus, or in English, representation of that Greek, Jesus. So, little word lesson at the beginning of this book. All right, so Hosea says this: the word of He who is that came to Hosea, the son of Beeri, in the days of Uzziah, That's also, his name is Azariah. So we already know when he became king. Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah. So we've got four generations of the kings of Judah that Hosea is going to be prophet under. And in the days of Jeroboam, the son of Joash, king of Israel. And only one king in northern Israel is mentioned. And I think the reason for that is because that helps us pin down when Hosea begins his story. It's while Uzziah and Jeroboam are kings in the two kingdoms. And so that puts Hosea's time somewhere in the 750s BC. That's when he starts his story. Verse 2. When he who is first spoke through Hosea, he who is said to Hosea, go, take to yourself a wife of whoredom and have children of whoredom, for the land commits great whoredom by forsaking he who is. So Hosea apparently lives in northern Israel, and he may already be acting as a prophet. I think he's a young man, unmarried at this time. And God says, okay, Hosea, I have an assignment for you. I need you to go and marry a woman that's going to cheat on you. Now, that's a pretty heavy-duty assignment. Now, his story will turn out better before we get to the end of it. I want you to understand that. But it's a rough one to begin with. And the reason for it is this. Hosea's life, his married life, is going to become an illustration of what God is putting up with in northern Israel. That he is married to a woman that won't stay faithful, no matter how much he loves on her. Okay. So with that in mind, let's read verse 3 next. So he went. So he was obedient. And he took Gomer, the daughter of Diblaim. So they get married. Now remember what he was already told. This woman is a wild woman. She's going to keep cheating on you. And she apparently does. So she ends up conceiving, and she bore him a son. Now, everybody wants to debate. Is this boy actually Hosea's son genetically, or is he somebody else's son? And the answer is, you don't know. But Hosea is his dad. He treats him as his son. So he who is said to him, call his name Yezreel. Yezreel is probably the better Hebrew pronunciation. For in just a little while, I will punish the house of Jehu for the blood of Jezreel, and I will put an end to the kingdom of the house of Israel. So this first boy is going to be named after the city where Jehu began his bloody reign. Because very shortly, Jehu's dynasty is going to come to an end. That's the prediction. Now, verse 5 is going to remind us, though, that the name Jezreel is not just simply the name of a city. On that day, I will break the bow of Israel in the valley of Jezreel, or Yezreel. So Israel is going to be broken, and it's going to happen in the Jezreel Valley. But we need to remember that the name Jezreel means God sows. The city of Jezreel is in the middle of a great, big, prosperous agricultural valley. And it got its name because God sows there. Keep that in mind. Verse 6. She conceived again, you know, after a couple of years probably, and bore a daughter. Now, is she genetically Hosea's? We don't know. He who is said to him, call her Lo Ruhamah, which in Hebrew means no mercy. For I will have no mercy on the house of Israel to forgive them at all. So I am coming to an end of my patience with northern Israel, basically. But I will have mercy on the house of Judah, and I will save them by he who is their God. I will not save them by bow or by sword or by war or by horses or by horsemen. So God is basically saying, in this coming judgment time with the Assyrians, Israel is done. But Judah is going to be protected for a little bit longer. Verse number 8. When she had weaned no mercy, she conceived and bore a son, and he who is said, call his name, not my people, Lo Ami. So not my boy, for you are not my people, and I am not your God. And so these kids now become representations of how God is feeling toward Israel, northern Israel. Verse 10. Yet the number of the children of Israel shall be like the sand of the sea, which cannot be measured or numbered. And in the place where it was said to them, you are not my people, it shall be said to them, children of the living God. And the children of Judah and the children of Israel shall be gathered together, and they shall appoint for themselves one head, and they shall go up for the land from the land, for great shall be the day that God sows, Jezreel. This, I believe, is a prophecy of the future resurrection of all those who have called upon the name of the Lord to be saved. Come back next time, we'll talk a little bit more about that.